SQL Down Under is a podcast for professionals working in the SQL Server community. SQL Server is a trademark of Microsoft Corporation. Opinions expressed during the podcast are individual opinions and may not reflect the opinions of SQL Down Under or of Microsoft Corporation.
Introducing Show 93 with guest Simon Sabin. Our guest today is Simon Sabin. Simon is the founder of Sabin.io, where he revolutionizes the data practices of his clients. Simon has a track record spanning diverse sectors like finance, retail, insurance, and motorsports, and is recognized as a data expert. I've known Simon for a long time. He was a data platform MVP from 2005 to 2024 and a fellow member of the Microsoft Regional Director Program. Simon's passion for community and learning led him to create SQL Bits. Since 2007, it's grown to be the largest data platform conference in the world. So welcome, Simon.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for inviting me.
It's so good to catch up with you again. It seems quite a long time since we last had a podcast with you. So tell us what's happening work-wise and things. What are you doing?
What we're doing, I think... We do all sorts of things to help companies do better data engineering, build their data platforms and help them be successful. And so we dabble in a bit of Fabric, we dabble in a bit of SQL. I'm still a SQL guy at heart, having sort of been doing it for many years. That number gets bigger and bigger, doesn't it, Greg?
It's interesting, actually. You did mention Fabric in amongst there too, so... How much work are you doing with Fabric? Is it what a reasonable proportion of your time? Or?
Yeah, I think the challenge we find, and I think we see this across the board, is that businesses want to do more with their data, and so the analytics part of things is the bit that gets the data out. That's where we see customers spending more of their dollars. The storing of their data is less of a thing, and it's more about getting their data out and doing the analytics and reporting and finding the insights.
Is the analytics more historical accounting and things like that, or is it more to do with better sales and marketing? Or
I think it's better sales and marketing, although I think as we used to say, is you can't do AI until you do BI, and you got these people that do want to do big complex insights, and they don't understand the basics of just numbers and analytics and definitions of metrics and some of those things, and people want to drive their business forward, and it's if you haven't got the basics of your analytics and your basic reporting, trying to do that progressive insights stuff is even harder. Helping customers. We've got a new customer at the moment that's trying to get insights, and they are it's a journey for the business, getting all the business to believe in, not just the gut feeling. It's that transition.
Yeah, that's right. Find. It's actually look at the data.
Actually, it's really hard, isn't it?
I remember a guy a number of years back said to me that he thought in the future that IT groups or departments would end up answering to a marketing leader. He thought that's how most businesses would end up being structured. And I don't know, it's interesting, my experience is that I do find businesses are more interested in spending money on the marketing side than on the accounting side, where the accounting is seen as a cost of doing business, where the marketing side is seen more as an investment in the company.
Yeah, I mean, it's the classic, isn't it? It's like, it's the cost center versus the like the revenue center. Like, if you can generate more revenue, like that's what matters,
right?
That's what matters, Jimmy. Like the fact that you've got like the Bill and Bob and Joanna in payroll and in finance that have got these spreadsheets that are coming out of their ears trying to balance the books, like, doesn't really matter, because like, you need to get more bums on seats. You need to sell more widgets and more wobbles, like, and that's what drives it. And yeah, I think that's what we always see, is that like the people with the budgets are largely the marketing and the salespeople.
Yeah, totally.
Not the internal folks.
I look at a company like, say, Amazon or something, and you know there must be some pretty good IT there in the background, from accounting and invoicing and payments and all that stuff. But you can guarantee that the people in those areas, they'll be full of headcount cutbacks and tightening budgets and all that sort of stuff, where the people who work out how to sell you more stuff, I'll bet their projects are funded at a completely different level.
Yeah, but it's ironic, because one of the epiphanies I had when I first started SQLBits, like, was we had hundreds of people registering and paying for things, and the process of reconciling those payments and processing them and putting them in the accounts, like, once you get above like 10, like, it starts becoming like a bit of a problem for a human to manage that stuff. And so the epiphany was like, oh, that's why people need computers to run sort of the internal systems of businesses, because like, it's not that you couldn't do it with humans, like the sort of Mechanical Turk approach of fixing stuff and processing stuff. But I think the problem is it becomes so complicated, and I think humans get like distracted and start making loads of mistakes, that you need those computer systems in place. But like, on the flip side, like, in, I mean, you probably find this with your businesses, if you end up dealing with sort of large multinationals, like, it's often really complicated to get into that process of payments and invoicing and accounts payable. Yeah. And you'd have thought, oh, surely it's like quick and easy, and you realize, no, it's not. Like,
not at all. I've often been surprised at the number of large businesses that obviously think we're a bank in the way they do things. And you just look at these gigantic companies and they're no. But actually, it sort of raises an interesting thing, is that if you want to grow a sort of a smaller business, I've always found that the best option is to find something that's missing in a big business and just keep supplying the thing that's missing there. But you've also got to be 100% comfortable with the fact that they might just close that gap that they opened. And you know, I've seen people lately who, I don't know, built like an add-on for YouTube, and it did various, you know, transcriptions of videos and various things. It did all this management. But then YouTube just eventually added that to their offering. And then the people who built the other one were just so upset, because they're saying they've just destroyed our business. And you think, well, yeah, but like, they created the gap in the first place. And if it's a profitable gap, you shouldn't be surprised if they close it.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like, I think that's why, like, that's why Google likes being in the Google business search business. They can see what people are doing. Like interestingly, in the new sort of AI world, like the chat GPTs of the world, like, people are like seeing the fact that if you're typing all your things into chat GPT, then people know what you're trying to do and what you're trying to build. Right? And if you're using them to code, they know what systems you're trying to build. So
yes.
Yeah, it's an interesting, wasn't it? Like,
I've found it interesting with chat GPT recently as well. is that when I go back and ask it more questions about various things, it now has a very detailed knowledge about the types of stuff I build, and it's built a really interesting detailed profile. Like I'll ask it a question, but it will say, look, as someone who does blah, 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 this is what you should. And I just think, hang on, that wasn't part of my question, you know, but it's obviously built this amazing context in the background. And that's, yeah, it's almost a bit creepy, but yeah, it does provide sort of richer answers. But sometimes I'm actually asking something unrelated to what I've done before. And so it's kind of funny when it then starts putting a slant on it based on previous discussions. So.
But people, there's this big AI buzz, isn't it, at the moment? But when you look at Google and all of the companies that we've been in close to tech for many years, and they've been using it in behind the scenes for a very long time. And
yeah.
You had the same with searches, is that I would find that it would know that if I asked for some technical database stuff, it would weight the SQL Server content more than the Oracle content, even though there was a Oracle function called regex, whatever, it would give me the SQL content. And so I think what's interesting me in the AI world, in the chat world, is the fact that these prompts are being built, and you can go and look at what's being built, and I'll be interested to see, you say it's complicated, or they've built this big mass of information about you. It's probably quite a small amount of information, but just concise, that says Greg writes this type of stuff. Very big.
Even when I've gone through building out courseware and things that we do, if I've asked it one or two questions in amongst various modules that I'm building, it eventually builds itself a picture of all the modules in the course, and so on and so on. It's kind of fascinating, what it's doing. But I think the thing that fascinates me with ChatGPT is what it learns from, and what the thing that intrigued me the most, I used to do baseball umpiring for years and years and years and years, and which is kind of odd for an Australian, but anyway, I did. And one of the things I still get from the Umpires Association is like a monthly thing saying, here's a bunch of questions, right? And so I've done those and I got 80 something percent or whatever. And I thought, I wonder how ChatGPT would have gone. And I went in, told it you're a AAA umpire and blah, 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 and gave it all the questions. It got about 40% right. And that really fascinated me. And when I looked into why it got them wrong, that there were several things. One that surprised me the most is that it got the hard questions right and the easy questions wrong. That dawned on me eventually, is that the only people who discuss the hard stuff are people who actually know something about it, right? Whereas the further you get down the list, you've got, everybody in the world with their own opinion on how they think the rules work, and they're wrong, right? So, how would it know who to believe or not, right?
Yeah,
So that's kind of fascinating. And the other thing is that it would get lost between softball rules and baseball rules because it's scraped something and not realized it was actually softball, not baseball, and so on. So, there was all this sort of stuff that it got wrong as well. And so it does trouble me where these things learn from. And how does it know whether something is trustworthy or not?
But that's the part of the challenge for tech, isn't it? It's things move on so quickly that, like, it, what's right today is not necessarily right tomorrow.
Even if it was right today, let alone being wrong. But yeah, even if it was right, that's right. And a year or two's time could be completely wrong.
Yeah, and we blogged back in the day, and one of the things that was always like, should you like take down old posts that are no longer relevant and all of that stuff? And yeah, it's a real challenge. And I think that's the nuance, isn't it, of how you can, as a user, filter out and fact check your AI to make sure that you are getting the right answer. And I think the interesting point is, in what scenarios do right matter? Like, obviously, playing baseball, like, if there's a rule, then like there is a right answer, and therefore like it's important, the fact that you get the right answer. However, like, there are a million ways to write a SQL statement. Like there are there are lots of ways that get you like the right answer. Like, some will get you the right answer in certain situations, some will not. Like, and so I think that's part of the challenge, isn't it? As a user, how do you fact check and make sure that you are getting a good enough?
Listen, what are you seeing in terms of usage of, say, ChatGPT versus Copilot at clients?
I can't say I've got enough critical mass to make a comment, really, but I do find that people use what they can get access to and what's available in the tool that they've got. So we've got a customer that's got some juniors that's just starting, and they started off using ChatGPT because that's all they had. And so they would write some Power BI reports using ChatGPT and build these amazing Power Query bits of M code. Have a clue what they do, what it does. I don't know whether you've ever done Power Query stuff, but if you're trying if you're trying to interact with a REST endpoint, and you've got to start doing paging and looping in M code, it's ugly. And if you're trying to do retries, it's really complicated.
I've seen people trying to pull down bank statements and things, that can only get page by page and so on. And in fact, I was dealing with the Bunny Stream REST API the other day. That's right. And at most, it'll let you pull down, say, 100 rows of something at a time. And if you've got, many hundreds, then straight away you're into how do I do the pagination, yeah.
And a slight digression. I do really like Power Query as a functional language. I think people don't. If you're a programming purist, understanding functional programming, etc., is a big thing, and I don't think people appreciate that, and the fact that so in theory it should be easily testable and all that stuff. But the
actually, it's a really good point, because so many people grow up just doing procedural style programming and think that's the only thing. It is one of the things that I loved when I was working at the university a long, long time ago. But it was the exposure to a whole lot of other types of languages and ways of thinking and so on. But the funny thing now is I look at a lot of the unis and things, and they're more like an adult education class. They don't seem to discuss any of these sort of things. And they're more focused on what is somebody currently using in the workplace, I mean, to give you an example, I was always fascinated with the Simula language, and it intrigues me that we don't have much in the way of a straight out simulation language nowadays, and things like that. And so what it would do is, the original version was in 1967, I might add, and they had concepts of classes and instances of classes and things. Like, it was so ahead of its time for what it did. But the idea was that if you wanted to, I don't know, simulate people coming to a counter, you built a class for the customer, you built a class for the person at the counter, you built all these classes, and then you just sort of sat back and watched what happened, right? But the thing that was really powerful is that every time you had a conditional, the equivalent of some sort of if, you also got to specify the odds on it going in each direction.
Okay.
And then it would automatically simulate in those proportions. Anyway, it was a wickedly powerful thing for the time it came out.
Yeah.
And I look at it now and I just go, where did those sort of languages go? You know, so it asks me why we don't have those things just commonly used.
Well, I don't know whether I was down a rabbit hole of YouTube like the other day, and there was a guy that was building, what was he building? I think he was building automaton stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how I got on this, but you know what it's like. It pops up in your feed. And this autonomous stuff, and he could build it in CAD, and there was then software that would allow him to simulate how this thing moves. Oh no, it was a string. He was trying to build something that based on strings. So the strings would pull the automaton to do the movements. And he could then program it, and he could then do some, I don't know, Arduino or something that would pull these strings. And he could basically, there was an app that would do all the simulations and do all the pulling and measuring and doing everything. And I was quite astounded the fact that there was this rich capability of a WYSIWYG editor for simulating this world. Yep. And you often don't know what you don't know. I mean, you don't, if you're not in that world, you don't know whether that thing exists or not. And it's I think it's always amazing what is available. Probably the nth degree is sort of the government, people that are doing stuff that top secret, that is way in advance, and then there's the stuff that you interact with day in, day out. The language,
the funny thing with a lot of the military stuff, though, I don't know if you've done much military stuff, but the thing that always fascinates me with that is how old it is. And so I've done training for, let's say, non-Australian but very large navies, and on things like big ships and submarines and things like, some of the systems were insanely old, but they were rolled out when the ship was rolled out, and it has a fairly long lifetime, and occasionally they might upgrade some of those things. But one of the challenges they have is that they've endlessly got to turn the staff over every few years, and so they need to retrain new people on very old concepts.
Well, I think
that's bizarre, but yeah.
But that's the reliability front, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we were talking about before we started talking about rabbit holes we go down when we pick up a project and we want to make a little tweak to it, and then you find some libraries are out of date, so you start updating things, and then you find there's a dependency nightmare. And the challenge being is that's the reason why they stick on these old things, is because they know that if every time they go and upgrade, they bring in a whole new risk world of change. And it's that little butterfly thing. You want to upgrade this version, and you've pulled in these 50 other libraries, and you are either you in that world, whether you want to stick in that that old version, a bit like I was saying that my mate's dad wouldn't upgrade his car, so he was driving a battered Volvo for decades, but he was happy with it. And but at some point, you've got to you've got to maintain it. And maybe
lot of the libraries too will have security vulnerabilities and things like that. So there'll be an imperative thing that it really does need to get upgraded, as well. But yeah, diabolically difficult at times to do it. But I'm going to ask you about what are the main parts of fabric that you guys have been using? All of it, or?
Well, all of it, but I think that's one of the interesting, which bit should you use? Should you be a lakehouse person? Should you be a notebooks person? Should you be a warehouse person? Where do you put your ETL? Where do you put your transformation logic? We're SQL folks, so we quite like sitting in the warehouse.
Even integration. I look at Data Factory and. Like I've used Azure Data Factory for a very, very long time. Well, for the length of time it's been out, basically. And if I look at Data Factory and Fabric, for a long time it's been nowhere near as capable, right? And so it was a tough decision to me to then start trying to use Data in Fabric because I just couldn't do what I was trying to do, right? And the weird thing is, of course, every day I'd get banners coming up saying, use this new thing instead. And I think, hey, I'd love to, but it just doesn't actually do the job. But clearly they've had an aim to improve it to the point where it's basically equivalent between, the Azure Data Factory and Fabric Data Factory. But it is, I think, one of the challenges I think they had with Fabric is that it's not like Power BI where they were competing in part of a market that really didn't have good solutions. Now they were competing with their own products that were more mature than the ones that are inside Fabric. And so I think that I found sort of slowed a lot of people down.
I think it's clearly a painful journey. I like the vision. I'm a programmer at heart, I know my customers aren't, and so being able to if they want to do some data analytics and ingest some data, then should they be learning Python or should they be able to do it in one of the data flows? What's the options for them? I think over time it will get better. There's a few things I quite like. I quite like the sort of the concepts of the deployment pipelines. I'm a DevOps guy. We try and help companies deliver more. My big mantra is happy engineers, and I believe that people are happiest if they're delivering. That's innately, if you get to the end of the day and you haven't shipped your bit of code, it's then sitting in your head and you want to be able to fix it. If you haven't shipped your fix, if you're shipping your fixes and shipping your code, then you're going to be happier because it's seeing it produced. I remember I was talking to someone the other day that when I first graduated and I got my interviews, I always talked about the fact that I liked solving problems, and I think lots of people in our industry like solving problems. And if you're not shipping stuff, you're not solving problems. Now there's an innate sort of agile delivery definition of done thing that we really work with customers on, making sure they realize when they are actually shipping fixes and committing stuff into source code, into source control, isn't getting it into people's hands and delivered is. I quite like the way that the deployment pipelines works and the source control integration. There are definite edges that
I was going to say the source code control integration was yet another reason why I was having issues, and where Azure Data Factory, I really quite liked how it played with source control and stuff like that. And it was another thing once I got into Fabric, it was yeah, things that there were just gaps, you know, and things. And so I think it's a long-term thing. Some of the ones that troubled me a bit, if I look at Fabric SQL Database, I remember asking somebody in the team, I said, like, what can I do with this that I can't do with Azure SQL Database? And the answer was nothing. And so I remember asking, then why does it exist? Right? Like that was the question. But the change that eventually happened is it became part of the same licensing. And then all of a sudden, that's a different story. But I mean, originally they were talking about billing it separately. And I mean, if that's the case, well, to me, I look at that and go, why is this an issue? It does frustrate me that even with those tools, everything started out case insensitive, and we're still working our way through collation issues and things like that. And that's something also that troubles me with Delta Parquet is, again, the data types that are supported by that and, you know, the naming conventions. And see, I look at Fabric and I think one of the things that they could have done that would have been a real winner is if they'd cleaned up the naming so that all the objects within there could use the same naming standards, right, and so on. But they've still got all the rough edges of the separate product. So, like, this thing can have underscores, that one can't, this can have hyphens, you know. So, you know what I mean? It's like, why is that? You know? And I know why it is, but I think it's something where they could have made a really serious contribution where it would have been drastically better than using the separate products.
Yeah, it's always interesting when sort of the underlying tech bleeds through to the implementation.
To the implementation,
like,
yeah.
And it's like, oh, really? Like, yeah, okay, you're storing this as JSON under the hood, therefore, like, X, Y, and Z, or
mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think one of the things that we do when we're working with customers is the concept of environmentalizing, like, what they're building to enable developers to build independently. We hate shared environments where multiple people have got their fingers in the pie and you're stepping on each other's toes, and like you've got to like coordinate check-ins and commits and all that stuff. So a big thing for us is that you try and give each engineer their own environment. And so the whole lake concept where your data is separate and your compute is like separate from your data so that you can spin up those environments is really, really important. The big thing to make that work is parameterization and configuration. And
see, I go further though, and what troubles me is that if I start with data that's say in a SQL server and I've got strongly typed data that plays nicely, I then take it out and stick it in files with a different data typing system. And in many cases, there's a potential for loss of integrity in that, only to then load it back up into a warehouse or a something that has a different type system. I'm like, conceptually, that's a problem for me. Right.
Yeah, I get that. I mean, I think that the type thing is painful, like, because, like, yeah, you've got type transforms in many layers, and like they're not like one for one mappings either.
No. So, and in fact, if you look at Parquet files, the number of supported data types in that is really small. And it doesn't even include things like a decent decimal data type or anything like that. So then you've got to go, like, is that what I really want to stick all my database data in? Not sure. But
yeah. Yeah, I get that. I get that. And it's one of those, like, what's important. And I think, like, we've talked about, like, are people needing to do, like, data for finance to run the business, or is it data to drive marketing? And I think there's two very fundamental different concepts. Like, does the number need to be right, or does the number need to be right enough?
Hi, this is Greg. Just wanted to thank you for listening to this show and let you know that if you'd like to let me teach you more about SQL Server,
We now have both free courses and low-cost courses available online and on demand. The courses include detailed hands-on lab work for you to complete to reinforce your learning, and there are more courses coming in the next few months. You'll find details at training.sqldownunder.com.
Yeah. And in the finance world, like, really, the number needs to be right.
It has to be right, yeah. Oh, look, I've also had clients who do, say, timber mills and things like that. And it's sort of interesting. When you get into Power BI, you've got a currency data type is the only accurate one, apart from a whole number. Like, and so they look at that, and if they're adding up money, they're totally happy with it, right, because they'll turn it into currency. But if they've got measures like of timber, you know, and things like that, where they want accurate decimal places, they don't want to make it currency. But then I get the, you know, you have the discussion of why can't Power BI add numbers up properly? You know what I mean? And worse, in the case of Power BI, they call it decimal, but it's actually a float.
And I this is
like, I mean, that's even like, scarier.
And how many people really understand that? And we had, current project, we had exactly that problem. It's like you're trying to balance thing, and it's like why is that not balancing? Zero is zero. Like, why is zero not zero? And it's like, because it's not zero, it's zero to like e to the minus like 9 or something. It's like, not quite. And that's like, that's the classic of like not understanding some little things. And when does it matter? If I'm doing the marketing stuff, doesn't really matter. If I'm doing the finance stuff, absolutely matters that like these balance to a certain like degree.
See, the other one for me is the case sensitivity. See, if I was building an analytic system, which is fundamentally what Fabric is, everything would have been case insensitive, right? Like, who builds an analytic system where everything is case sensitive, you know? Got to tell you, none of my customers want that, right? Case preserving, no argument. But case sensitive, no.
I trained on Oracle back in the day. And,
yeah.
And there was part of me that was like, the OCD-ness likes it being like matching and being good.
Yeah.
But my lazy head is like, oh, really? Really? But
like, we've got a state code, a VIC. Like, I mean, if somebody's querying the data, I don't care whether they type in a capital V and a little IC or whatever. They just expect it to find the same data, you know? But I mean, whatever I set it up as, I want it to come back that way. So I want it preserved, whatever I do, but I sure don't want it part of the query, right, in terms of, yeah. And so I look at that, and it just sort of is annoying to me that we're still trying, so many people complaining and saying they need to get back to a case insensitive thing, and you just think, well, why wasn't it that way in the first place? But anyway, it's...
I don't envy anybody trying to run a platform at that scale.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I don't like managing like the few libraries that we've got with like the few customers we've got, like, let alone like having to build a system that is going to be used by the world and multinationals, and there's going to be experts like us like picking it apart, like,
mm-hmm.
like, that like ship ready, like, fascinating. And how do they get it out quick? Because they're competing with like the Wix and Snowflake and Amazon, yeah, etc. And like
most of which, I might add, are case sensitive as well.
Well, that, yeah. that's the danger, isn't it? It's like, well, that's always the argument. Like, if you want to get something done, like, you want to show that the competitor is doing it. If the competitor's not doing it, the weight you've got to try and get something done. But I do think Yeah.
I've been doing a whole lot of work with other database engines lately, and I got to tell you, every time I query something in a database and everything comes back in uppercase and stuff like that, it just feels like I've suddenly jumped back to the 1960s, you know, or something.
Got your green screen out.
Yeah. Or times when we had 6-bit ASCII or 7-bit, you know, that's the sort of thing. I remember working on systems that had, very constrained character sets. But it's not where I want to be today. Hey, but listen, the thing that I really wanted to ask you about this time is about bits. Talk to me about bits. Yeah. Because if ever there's a conference around the world that I've kicked myself for years that I haven't managed to get across to, it's BITS. And so,
have you never been?
I have not been across, no. And oh my goodness, it will happen. So yeah,
I thought you'd came like right in the early days, but
no. Didn't manage to.
To be fair, it's a long way.
I've done like little tours around the UK and things like that, and done user groups and stuff. BITS. Anyway, it's one I've been kicking myself forever. It always seems to be the place to be each year when these things come around. And so tell us about the next one.
So, yeah, next one's in April next year at the ICC Wales, which is...
Is that in Cardiff?
No, it's in Newport.
Just
down the road. But it's... you can fly into Cardiff or Bristol or Birmingham. Very easy to get to. We were there 3 years ago, and it was probably one of the best venues in the sort of recent venues we've been to, because we just take the place over, and so it's like really, really nice in terms of just nice space. And I don't like conferences, so I build SQLBits to be like the place that I would like to go to as an attendee. Yeah. So trying to make it as relaxed, trying to make it so that attendees can really enjoy the experience. Because there's lots going on, there's lots of choice. So we work really hard.
So there's not really a theme. Is there a theme announced for this one yet?
Not yet.
Not yet? Okay. What was the last one?
The last one was Neon, which very, very spookily, Amazon bought Neon, the data analytics platform, when we were running. So that was quite.
Neon's not a bad platform. I've used that for a few Postgres things and stuff like that. Yeah, it's actually pretty cool.
Yeah, everyone needs their database, don't they? And so that, I think that's the interesting point, is that whilst it's SQLBits, and we started off very focused on SQL Server, I think because the especially the European side of the community had a lot of Power BI interest, we've always been very broad in terms of the content we have. So whether it's SQL Server 2025, whether it's Power BI, whether it's Fabric, whether it's general data analytics, we've got your back covered in terms of the content. And I think we're really proud of the fact that we're independent.
That's a really big thing. The fact that it's an independent conference as well. Yeah.
We have Microsoft, Amazon, etc. sponsoring us, and we have lots of speakers from Microsoft come over and talk about all of the great things in Azure Data, but our big focus is on independence, real world experience. So trying to be successful, understanding do you choose data warehouse, do you choose Lakehouse, do you use SQL DB, do you install SQL on a VM or managed instance, how do you move from on-premise to the cloud, all of those things, experts like yourself come along and really talk about the experiences that can enable people to be successful. Remove the marketing fluff, give you the content that enables you to succeed as a data engineer. because, I mean, I don't know about you, but choice nowadays is like, it used to be, well, you were either a SQL place or an Oracle place, and
yeah,
generally you didn't have much say in that. It was like pretty much done for you, whereas now, like, you can spin up what you want, where you want, and how you want it, can't you? It's
and it's ironic that things like probably the easiest way to spin up an Oracle system today is in Azure, right? So, it's funny how the industry changes. Yeah, so.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? It's so easy. Mm. I mean, just the thought of spinning up like this, what you can spin up nowadays, like, it's just scary.
Actually, there's a really good question though too. Do you, like, what percentage of the time do you use Azure SQL Database or managed instances or SQL on a VM? Have you got a?
So we've got different customers that have got different I'd say that, like, if you really want SQL and you're moving into the cloud, I would pretty much go VMs. I think the other.
That's if you don't want to change anything.
Yeah, the other options are just, there's too many like constraints that make it like not great. And generally, if you've got an existing thing, then experience is you're probably doing things badly from a like loading perspective, because so your IO pattern.
Oh yeah, it'd be terrible. And as soon as you insert latency in there or something, it's things are horrible.
But then we've got like customers that are cloud born that are using SQL Database like really well for scale out. And I think to be that level of scale, then you've got to have capability, you've got to have skills that you can manage those things and understand how you can manage and operate your cloud. Otherwise, your cloud becomes very expensive.
I look at our own admin stuff, and years and years and years ago, I'd have SQL in a VM that, you know, was hosted somewhere, and that's what we'd be using. And I can't tell you how often I'd have to do things because the VM, you know, need some attention or things or whatever. And I've got to tell you that since the day we moved it across to an Azure SQL Database, like many years ago, I haven't even thought about it since.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it just works. And so for most of my client things, that's kind of the level of what I really want most of the time. But the thing is, if you're migrating stuff from an existing system, it can be a tough call to do that. And it also fascinates me that where I've always thought the SQL team has got the marketing, because when I look at Azure SQL Database, they are mostly marketing it to existing large SQL Server customers. And I always think then the entire discussion is about what's different or what's missing.
Yeah.
Whereas they need to be talking to the people building greenfield stuff who are currently using Postgres or things or whatever, or MySQL, and just going, hey, this is a really good platform that you should be building your business on, you know, or building your apps on. That's an entirely different discussion about how good it really is in terms of what's there, rather than a discussion about what's different to the on-premises version of SQL Server. I mean, to me, it's just completely the wrong audience.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think there was, if we look back over the past like X years, it's an interesting journey in terms of realizing that that migration dream of migration from like a SQL on a VM locally to PaaS really pie in the sky. There's just too many differences. And I think the problem is that just understanding what those nuances are required knowledge and skill, but also the capability to understand that you're getting bitten by that thing. And most people don't have rich test systems that they can put in place to go and validate this stuff. So you'd end up with it, you'd go onto it, and then you'd find you'd be bitten by X, Y, and Z.
To me, the biggest one is just the chattiness of most of the applications. They just don't play nicely in a cloud environment. I mean, even if I look at I remember the earlier versions of Microsoft CRM, for example, just to bring the home page up on one of my clients, it was like 90,000 calls to the database. You know, you just go like, what?
You know?
And it was because they just opened a cursor and then pulled row by row, every row. And the first thing they did when they opened the first screen is load all the contacts or whatever. You go, well, that's cool if there's 10 of them, but it's not cool if there's 90,000 of them, you know. And so, yeah, they just hadn't thought through that stuff for that sort of environment. In fact, what I used to love actually is I remember many, many years ago, someone, you know, they used to get their developers, instead of working on a web server that was on the same machine as the database, they'd have them with a dial-up modem between the two, you know. But so you become really aware of every call you make to the database. Yeah.
Yeah, we had. I've got one customer that I still to this day I in contact with, that I remember walking around St. Albans, and he'd been given my number by Tony Rogerson, also ex like SQL MVP, and this guy had got this problem, and his problem was the fact that he had a web server or an app that was sitting in the UK and the database was in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
And like, it was just all about the chattiness and the round trip and the fact that the round trips were just killing him.
It's terrible.
But isn't it interesting how...
It's a tribute to SQL Server that those apps worked in the first place.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting how, like, things evolve in that memory became an issue, and then it didn't become an issue because memory was like really cheap.
Yeah.
And that and networks were an issue because you had like wide area networks that are like 1 meg or not even that. It was in kilobytes, wasn't it? Then that doesn't become an issue. But then you then go to the cloud and it then becomes an issue again, and you have to start optimizing back down. And then you want to go to SQL Database and you have to start not being so chatty. And it's interesting how this cycle of optimization comes around.
One of the applications I worked on a while back, I remember from when they got to the login screen to when the first next, like the next thing came up, they'd already made 400 database calls, you know what I mean? Just to log on. And so you think, like, that should be one, two, maybe something like that. But it's just, and then they had reports that literally would make hundreds of thousands of remote procedure call or calls to the database, and you just go like, the thing is, no matter what you do, is as soon as you put, doesn't matter how small the latency is, you stick a tiny bit in that, and then all of a sudden you're talking about serious delays, you know, and those things.
Well, I mean, I remember when we first started using Data Factory, and I, having been integration services board, where I learned from Mr. Farmer and all his team about the optimizations of ODBC and how they'd got it down to optimizing size of bits and bytes. And so you could run a sys package that could do an incremental load of 1,000 tables in a few seconds, because it would just split through them. You do 1,000 tables incrementally loaded in ADF. That's 1,000 activities that have to start up, and every startup takes 10 seconds. Take 10 seconds, and it's just this has taken an hour just to do nothing, to go and check out. And it's just, how these things change. And I don't know about you, but I find that all our customers have data in PaaS platforms, some SaaS platform somewhere. And so, you talked about your bunny APIs, you've always calling APIs. And so, understanding the latency of calling those, and also the fact that you've got to retry them, and you've got to page through results and all of those things.
A lot of them have throttling and that sort of stuff as well. Yeah. It is a real challenge calling a lot of that stuff.
And I'm
I'm amazed what we get done with ADF, though, right? I mean, like, I mean, there's some things where I look at, you know, how complex the thing is, and we're done very quickly. But I have other things where I look and I just want to poke my eyes out, you know, as to how complex. I mean, simple example, the fact that if I have a value in a variable, I can't just change it and put it straight back in the same variable, right? So things like that, you just go like, really?
variables are just like, the cost of using variables is just so extortionate compared to what it is. Like, it's like, really? Like, now you've got config variables, like,
yeah,
in Fabric. I do wish it was more FiveChan-esque. You ever used FiveChan?
Yeah.
Like, I think that there's not enough SaaS-ness for Data Factory for ingesting data from third parties. That's probably my big wish. I'm fascinated to see the sort of the FiveChan DBT like joining forces and seeing where that
actually goes. The showstopper for us was the inability to have multiple schedules with parameters. Right, that was just a complete showstopper for us because that's again an example of something they've been fixing recently. But I look at when it came out, and I look at today's date and go, that's a long time in between the two to do a function that was already there in the first place in ADF, right? So,
yeah.
But it's like somebody had decided to dumb down the scheduling stuff and make it, maybe they thought it was easier to use, but the problem is it was nowhere near as functional as what was there before. So, so whenever they were saying, why don't you move, it's all those sort of rough edges were the sort of things that were problematic. Yeah.
And I think, under the hood, whilst it looks the same thing, it's not the same thing. So they're still having to do that whole MVP sort of skateboard, scooter, like motorbike, car progression thing. So what gets in the MVP and what doesn't? But like back to my environmental.
But they have been filling it out lately, right? So, I mean, a lot of that stuff. I noticed in the last release they have had finally multiple schedules and stuff like that.
But parameterizing schedules is still hard. Like, there's still lots of things that, like, if you want to configure and parameterize, it becomes, quite tricky.
I actually see, again, I suppose it's your background too. I mean, I look at the options in ADF where it was more like a cron thing where you could just sort of like type in the times that you wanted a thing to run effectively and it would just run it for you. And so that seemed really straightforward. But then when you start getting into a graphical thing where you got to go and pick off things and pick, oh my goodness.
it's fascinating. I remember sitting in a presentation when, like, in the early ADF days, and one of the PMs was really excited because they had this code-driven data flow piece. Mm-hmm. Like it could all be defined in JSON, and it was like all great. And it was like, and you've got no GUI. It's like okay. And then you go full circle. And like you go, well, okay, we've taken out some of the easy configurability, and it's now more GUI based. And
question: how often do you start building a pipeline by copying the JSON from another pipeline?
Hardly ever, because it's a bit like Terraform and stuff. It's like
all the time, particularly if I'm copying a pipeline from one project into another. You know, and so on. So,
but are you copying the thing or are you copying the JSON?
The JSON.
Interesting.
So what I'll do is I'll create a new pipeline and then open up the JSON and paste it in. As long as I've already got the linked services and stuff in place, then it's totally fine. The weird thing is that it won't let you change the name of the pipeline in the JSON. And so you open it up and you paste in all the JSON, but you can't change the name. So I find I have to create a pipeline with exactly the same name as the source one, or I'm going to have to modify it in the JSON when I paste it in. But
you're not copying individual component JSON.
No. The whole pipeline. Yeah, right. And, okay. And so it's things we had a standard thing for processing semantic models or processing Azure analysis services, right? Things like that. And I just wanted a copy of that pipeline over there. Yeah. So.
Yeah, the whole framework thing, a bit like conversation about, like, you want to be able to ship libraries of capabilities, like, and you can't do it in SQL at the moment. Like, you can't take a package, a framework that you can deploy easily. And I think, like, it's still, there is capabilities in Fabric for doing it, but I think there's still lots of copy and paste, isn't there? Of items, which then means if you want to go and upgrade and stuff, it becomes harder. But
the weird thing is that some of that stuff is actually harder to do in Fabric as well. It sort of fights you a bit on that, which I suppose I'm not surprised. But anyway,
I do find from a conversation perspective at a CFO level. The whole SaaS platform of, like, buy this compute and it does your thing. And I'd be interested to see the distribution, the tail of customers versus SKU size, because I think, like, sure, there are businesses that need like 10 F128s, like, but there's a long tail that can live on F2s and F4s.
Yeah, that's right.
Like, and, like, you can do quite a lot on, like, a small SKU.
Well, now, again, a lot of the things required F64 at first. But and so, again, to me, that was one of the things that slowed things down is the fact there were so many things you couldn't do if you're on a smaller SKU. And to me, they were things that were really not optional, you know, some of the things like security things and stuff like that. And, like, I don't care how small the thing is, I want to be able to do the security stuff right, you know, and so on. So even there, I mean, we've finally got workspace identity, but we don't really have a good equivalent of managed identity, and certainly not user assigned managed identity and those sorts of things. And see, again, I don't know, maybe the average user with SaaS intentions has no interest in that, but they should.
you mean you don't like copy and pasting client IDs and secrets into
and passwords and things? Like you say, yeah, how do you connect from a semantic model in Fabric to a SQL database? And the answer nearly always still is with a SQL login and password. Really? Is that where we're back to? It's all kind of wrong, you know. And where, again, in ADF, I can do system identity, I can do user assigned managed identities, you know, that's all that stuff just works, you know. And so it was another thing that is challenging when I've sort of moved across to the fabric equivalent of it. So
but I go back getting those things right. You'd have thought those things are internally for Microsoft should be fairly, like, cookie cutter. As a service, I need to be able to have, like, system assigned.
See, I suppose the problem with identity, though, is what Azure sees as an object. You know, like, you've got this big shared thing, and, like, what is the thing you attach the identity to? So the workspace isn't really an Azure object, probably. So, and then you're in a big shared environment. Yeah, I don't know.
And someone's got to store secrets somewhere. And, like, so, yeah, I think it's a. And you've got to cycle through things. You could. Yeah, it's
I had to laugh the other day. I heard someone I was in a meeting somewhere, and they said they thought that Microsoft was slowly rebuilding Azure in Fabric. And there's a certain truth to that. We're sort of slowly getting things that are part of Azure as being surfaced within Fabric as new objects again. And so, yeah, it's kind of odd.
It's very astute. I mean, I think... Yeah, I'm surprised there's no like apps in there. Like,
yeah,
I reckon that will come.
It's got her right.
Because then you essentially become accessing the cloud, don't you? Like, you've got your
functions have already dropped in, and from Power BI you can click on buttons and run functions like. It's sort of heading a bit in that direction.
Yeah, we've got no data entry at the moment. Like,
no.
Once you've got that, then it's the true access replacement. Like,
that pretty much brings us to time. So is there anywhere people are going to see you? Oh, well, obviously Bits we talked about, but is there anything else coming up that you want people to know about?
Not really. I mean, I think early bird... Our pricing finishes at the end of this month, so get along. I think TickerBits is always, I'd be interested for folks down under as sort of like costly, the cost of going to a conference. Come to the UK, it's probably...
it's pretty high, that's for sure. Mm.
But it's probably similar to the US. I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends on...
Sometimes it's a little bit longer. I think it depends where you start in the country, to be honest. Again, the country's big enough that it kind of depends where you start. And also with the different airlines, some are much more direct than others. You know, like I remember going to one of the longest days I ever remember. I started in Canberra and I ended up flying Canberra, Melbourne, Hong Kong, London, Paris.
Wow.
And I got out the other end and I'm like, ugh. It was like just completely ridiculous. Where if I'd gone on, say, Singapore Airlines, I could have flown straight to Singapore and then straight to Paris. So it was just I was on One World Airline at the time. So, yeah, I mean, I think the airline groups can make a huge difference to the distance you end up traveling and stuff as well. So, but Qantas has started having direct Perth London flights now, and that's a pretty long flight. But even then, you've got to get to Perth. So, yeah. And I mean, from here, that's a multi hour flight to get to Perth. So,
yeah, I'm not sure I'd like the long flight. I think I'd quite like just to be able to get off and walk my legs.
And the nice thing with going through Singapore is it's just my favorite airport in the world, you know. I mean, like, at Changi Airport, it's just unbelievable. I mean, business travelers rate it as the number one business airport in the world nearly every year. You know, it's just so cool. I love Changi. It's one of the airports where they decided they wanted to be a good hub, and they just did everything required to be a good hub. Yeah, and so it was like the first airport I went to that had free Wi-Fi, for example.
Right, okay.
You know, or things like if you wanted to go and sleep, you know, there were little airport hotel things or bed things, and you could just go and sleep, right? Whereas here in Melbourne, if you want to go and sleep, like you're stuck for hours, people just lay along the seats, right? And then they didn't like people doing that, so they put armrests. So now they all lie on the floor, right? And so... This is not thinking through, you know, how to be a good hub, right? And just the number of things in the airport and around the airport's just amazing. You know, like I was there one Christmas and it was like a winter wonderland, you know, and inside the airport, you know, like little buildings and snow-capped things and trees, and you just go, that's astonishing, you know. So, and if you're there, Chinese New Year, of course, is the other time of the year that's just unbelievable inside the airport, you know. And now they've got a whole separate thing with waterfalls and, you know, all sorts of stuff inside the airport. It is really something. So yeah, you need to fly to Changi just to have a look.
I will try that.
Yeah, if you come down under, yeah, head through Changi and leave a few hours to have a good look. Yeah, so it's awesome. Yeah, okay. Hey, listen, so anyway, thank you so very much for taking part today, Simon.
Thanks for the chat, Jake. And
awesome.